Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Nature Now. After a sunny weekend for the Rhody Festival in Port Townsend, was that ever beautiful? The rhododendrons bloomed just in time, even that pink, fluffy state flower, the rhododendron macrophyllum. Today, we will consider how birds eat with Christy Lassen from Birds Unlimited in Gardner. But first, the mystery sound. Observations in our beautiful world. The first is May brings bloom.
Sightings of native flowers this last week include the orange honeysuckle, Lanessera ciliosa. Also, thread-leaf phacelia, purple flowers common east of the mountains but seen by Wendy Tweeten here in small areas. Wendy lists several wildflowers on the website iNaturalist.
And white wildflowers are very common now. My favorite is Clatonia, which is known probably to many of you as miner's lettuce. Add this to salads. I'm not really big on eating weeds, but miner's lettuce is not a weed. It is just a very delicious food. My mother always put it in salads from her California woods. It has rounded light green leaves. It's tender and tasty. Small white flowers, which you can eat or not. Lamaceum nudicale, which is nicknamed bare stem biscuit root. It sends up leafless stems with tiny cream yellow flowers. Biscuit root does not indicate food. At least miners did not make biscuits from this. However, some Washington State tribes made tea from the leaves. Roots in the carrot family were gathered before bloom or eaten raw or cooked.
Bright yellow stream violet, Viola glabella, also blooms now. And a thorough guide to wildflowers is Wildflowers of the Pacific Northwest by Mark Turner. It's a great book.
It is a wonderful book. He went all over for about 5 years taking pictures of everything he could find. And we now get to something not half as beautiful. This is an orange water invader. It is Noctiluca. And Noctiluca generally gets to Puget Sound in spring, but arrived much earlier than expected this year. The swarm of millimeter-long Noctiluca organisms, while not toxic to humans, devour vital nutrients in Puget Sound, creating a leak in the food chain. And this was announced by State Department of Ecology ecologist Christopher Krems in the Seattle Times. In large numbers, Noctiluca eat all the lipid-rich diatoms and other nutritious organic material. That leaves creatures like herring and salmon deprived. The currency here is lipids, Krem said, referring to fish that need the fats lipids provide to survive in cold water. At the base of this is diatoms, food that supports what we consider commercially interesting organisms. When Noctiluca feed off the diatoms, they're cannibalizing the food chain. Not good news. Thanks to the Seattle Times article on May 19th. A common name, by the way, for Noctiluca is tomato soup plankton because they have a very distinctive orange-red color.
Out in Chimicum, a deadly nerve toxin in Anderson Lake has exploded in 1 week, from more than 9 times the recreational threshold to nearly 5,000 times the allowable amount of 1 microgram per liter, stated the Jefferson County Health Department on May 19th. The lake right now is closed to all recreation. The toxin is created by blue-green algae, a natural occurrence that at times produces poisons. Researchers do not know what prompts the release of the toxin, but they do know that warm weather encourages algae growth and thus the possibility of toxins in the water. Nutrients such as phosphorus and nitrogen also feed algae growth. Anderson Lake has previously tested positive for antitoxin A, and sadly, one pet dog was killed this month by brief exposure. That is per the Peninsula Daily News on May 9th.
And since we have spoken of things that give us the shivers, we're going to do something now that we will thoroughly enjoy. Christy Lassen is here to talk with us. She gets many, many questions about birds in the Wild Birds Unlimited store in Gardner that she owns with her husband, Mark Lassen. Today, we'll explore with her some of the ways birds find food and how some of them store it. Hi, Christy. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Mary. Thank you.
I've always figured it's not easy being a bird. And the first thing might be, how do they find food? How do they know there's something edible around?
Most birds find food visually. Birds find it by flying around and visually surveying an area. They look from the tops of trees. They scan for potential new sources of food. Some birds, like vultures, can actually smell food. They're one of only a very few amount of birds in North America that have a developed sense of smell. Parrots are also a bird that has a good sense of smell. But most birds find food visually. One interesting thing, too, with raptors, they have been found to be able to track prey's ultraviolet trails.
Did I hear that right?
Yes, it sounds kind of weird.
Prey leaves an ultraviolet trail?
Yes, they do. So what mice and rodents do is when they run along trails, they actually urinate. And their urine absorbs ultraviolet light. Raptors can see light from the ultraviolet spectrum, and they can actually track the little mice trails. As a raptor is soaring through the sky, they can look down and see the little trails that the mice are running on, and that helps them find a snack.
I don't think Disney has ever picked up on this, but it would certainly make an interesting cartoon.
Put a little twist on there.
Although, right, but it's pretty amazing, because do people know if only raptors can see these trails?
Well, all birds actually can see ultraviolet light.
Okay.
They have different rods and cones in their eyeballs than humans do, and so they can actually see ultraviolet light.
Wow. We've got birds soaring, raptors, of which we have many beautiful ones around here. I love the red-tailed hawk. They can do that, but what about if you're not soaring, but you just happen to be on the ground, standing around?
Well, I think even those birds, and you can see this in quail, like quail do lots of surveying where they get up on a fence post, they stand on top of a tall branch, and they, you know, they're surveying, they're looking around. But then those birds also are big time scratchers. You know, they get down in the dirt and they start throwing things around. Sometimes you'll hear like a crazy loud noise in the bushes and leaves are flying everywhere. And then out pops just a little towhee. I mean, they're big scratchers. They throw bark out of all of our flower beds every day onto the sidewalk. So,
but they don't come after that with little brooms,
do
they?
No, they do not. No, that's our job.
A ground feeding bird is primarily going to be looking for either insects in the duff or seeds and other nibbles in that
Definitely.
Order.
Definitely. Yep. Seeds, grass seeds, little bugs, little insects, bird seed that falls out of your feeder. They're great little vacuum cleaners.
Do any birds eat mushrooms? I mean, that's just an open question. Maybe we'll put it out there. Anybody who's listening to us and knows whether birds take a bite out of a mushroom, I'd be interested to know.
Well, I don't think it's completely impossible. I mean, a lot of the corvids, well, corvids are omnivores. They eat almost everything.
So that's the crows and the ravens and the jays.
Yep. Okay. I wouldn't put it past them. I don't know for sure. But
maybe they only eat morels on certain days when they've been properly sunburned.
Sauteed. Yes.
So we've got the birds finding this or that, but who of the bird population stashes food for later?
So chickadees, nuthatches, some of the woodpeckers, and the jays are all food stashers. There's also a species of bird that we have out here in higher elevations that's called a Clark's nutcracker. And they have been seen to store up to 10,000 seeds in one season. They are seed hoarders.
I don't know who's counting, but that's fascinating. Yep. I saw Clark's nutcracker take a sandwich out of a man's hand up on Hurricane Ridge, because this man was leading a group of us and he was saying, "Do not feed the birds. Do not feed the birds." And
making
he was
a point,
gesticulating,
point with
gesticulating with his sandwich.
That's
that
funny.
Was the end of that. But they got it stashed, but then how do they find it?
Black-capped chickadees, they not only remember where they store their seeds, but what caches they have already eaten, which ones have been pillaged by other critters, and which ones have their favorite seeds. So they put, you know, like the favorite stuff over to the side in the root cellar, you know, to keep for later. They've been seen doing this, and studies have shown that they can remember
all of their caches almost around 30 days, plus minus 28 days, which is a long time. I can't remember where I left my keys, you know, every
day.
Well,
I'm thinking that we should probably get people to stop using the expression bird brains as if it were something derogatory.
Definitely.
Not at all.
No.
But although I'm thinking that the chickadees then must be continuing to stash through a season because they stash, eat, they just keep stashing as well
definitely,
as eating.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yep. Jays, an interesting thing that I just read too, was that jays only cache viable seeds. They will only store things that they know will be preserved, that won't go bad if they put them in a little storage cell, you know? they know what to store and what not. It's pretty amazing. I read about a study that they did when researchers went and looked at the stores that the jays were hiding, that only about 10% of the whole thing were unviable seeds, which is a pretty good ratio. I mean, more things go bad in my refrigerator than that.
Yes, you get sort of afraid to open the door.
Yes.
Right. Jays are right up there with crows in terms of bright behavior, right? They're right there.
Very smart.
Very, very bright. That gets us to something I have seen birds do. Why do they wipe their beaks? I mean, I've seen them leaning over and wiping their beaks, and it doesn't look like something's dripping.
Well, I think there's something out there that's called the napkin principle with birds. And that, you know, I believe it's just that they don't want to have food on their faces, just like us. I was thinking, you know, hummingbirds have been observed doing this.
Yes.
They reach their bills into a nectar feeder, and they don't want to have sticky sugar water on their bill.
Their tongue is taking the sugar water out, but it has to go past their bill
in order to do it. Definitely, they're getting a little nectar.
Yeah.
And even into a flower to get nectar. Mm-hmm. They're getting a little nectar on their bill, so they're just wiping their mouths off. You see it a lot when birds eat suet, too. You know, if birds come up to a suet feeder, they'll take a bite, and sometimes they get it kind of all over their face, and then they take a little time, and they wipe their bills and their faces off. There's another theory, too, that doing that is a behavior that helps them keep their bills in good shape, kind of like us filing our nails. Mm-hmm. Bird bills are made out of the same material that fingernails are, and they never stop growing.
Like keratin.
Keratin, yep.
Yeah.
Birds need to kind of keep those bills in good shape. And a study I read about, they observed birds using rougher surfaces than smooth surfaces the majority of time when they were doing this. So there is, I think, a purpose to that behavior where they are actually kind of like filing their bills
looking
down.
For something that might serve as a rasp.
Something I thought of too is that in caged birds, a lot of people who have caged birds put up the cuddle bone.
Yeah, or
you know,
pumice.
Which is,
kind
pumice
of almost
stone.
Like pumice.
Yep.
Yeah, right.
And they do that so the birds can keep their bills in good shape. I think it has something to do with that natural instinct for the birds to kind of keep their bills filed down a little bit.
Given that we have got birds that have to eat, what can they find in the native landscape that keeps them fed? I mean, there are some birds that are berry eaters, right?
Definitely. Berry plants are a huge resource for birds. There's a plethora of native plants that grow out here that provide great resources for the birds, with not only food, but habitat and shelter and things like that.
Okay.
Berry bushes are wonderful. Blackberries, the red twig dogwoods are great. Elderberries, both blue and red elderberries are great. Black twinberry is one of my favorites. It's a berry that brings in western tanagers.
Wow.
And cedar waxwings.
I've never planted
yard.
That one. I think I need to get a couple.
Black twinberry is wonderful.
Oh, nice. Black twinberry. Okay.
Service berries, bunch berries, Oregon grape.
Mm-hmm.
Sumac is wonderful. Salal is great. Salmon berries, snowberries, thimbleberries.
If it has berry at the end of its name.
Definitely. Well, those are some of the natives, you know,
right,
that we can have out in our yard that help bring in the birds, too.
Do you think that birds are eating in ways that we never see them? Because I know that I have some berries here and there that I never see a bird in. I'll see a cedar waxwing in a certain plant, but I don't always see anybody getting the big blackberries when they're ripe. You'd think something would. And they probably are, and I'm just not observing.
I have seen evening grosbeaks and black-headed grosbeaks working on blackberry bushes. So there's birds that are eating them. I think sometimes, you know, the ones that hit the ground, too.
Birds are
eating those as well.
Okay.
Some of the birds aren't really good at perching on the branches and grabbing the berries, so they have to wait for them to fall on the ground.
Okay. Is there any bird that you particularly enjoy seeing in a berry bush.
Oh, all of them, honestly, all of them. We have a big crabapple tree in our yard. And just the other night, I was watching a yellow warbler just working the buds of it. So it hasn't produced the berries yet. It was getting little bugs and eating little buds off of it. And the flowers were blooming and the sun was shining through it. And it was just spectacular.
Postcard picture.
It was beautiful. And I always love seeing like the cedar waxwings and the western tanagers. I always feel really lucky to get to see them in the backyard. And they're not the easiest ones to draw in. They're not big feeder birds. They do like to bathe. Water brings them in, but berry bushes really is what attracts them.
2 years ago, I saw a male cedar waxwing feeding a female a berry, which she ate. Why don't we talk, just for the end of this, on the question of when it's necessary to feed birds and what people know about how birds use what's at a feeder. Because obviously you're very involved in helping people have home feeders. And I know from talking with you that you had some interesting thoughts about that.
So I do. I kind of feel like it's always necessary to feed the birds. Washington State Fish and Wildlife has an interesting statistic on their website that says every year in Washington, 35,000 acres of wild habitat is lost to commercial and residential development.
35,000?
35,000.
Oh, yeah.
And just here on the peninsula, with the amount of clear cutting that's happening, I feel like it's always necessary to feed the birds in some way. And that doesn't necessarily mean like throwing a feeder out there. My feelings about bird feeding are that I'm giving back to the birds what the habitat could have produced if my house was not sitting right where it is, if that parking lot hadn't paved over, you know, X amount of trees and plants, if the road hadn't taken out habitat for the birds.
Sure.
Not only putting out bird feeders, but we plant tons of native plants and feed them naturally. And I feel like if people can just do those things, your house, what it's sitting on, used to provide habitat and food, resources for birds and wild animals. And to be able to give back just a little bit, plant those natives, plant those plants that provide food and shelter for birds and other animals.
One of the wonderful things about many of our native plants, I'm thinking particularly of salal, is that they're beautiful at all times of the season. I know people get fussed about salal, but I think it is a glorious plant. And so one of the things then is that we do need to keep planting native plants.
Definitely.
Okay. The other thing is, sometimes it's a little hard to find them. The conservation district, I know, is one place.
There are two native plant nurseries in Sequim.
Okay.
One new one and one that's been out there for a little while that's associated with the Olympic National Park.
Oh, right. It's both, where they rebuilt for the Elwha. They grew the plants to refurbish the
Elwha.
Both
great resources. And then our store also sells native plants as well. We stock a lot of native plants for sale to the public. One last thing I would like to tell you, too, about birds and feeding. Just always like to tell people this because it's something that people don't really think of that often, is that birds never become dependent on a bird feeder. They never lose their natural ability or their natural instincts to migrate or forage for the things that they need because of a bird feeder. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology has studied this, and they have shown that feeding at a bird feeder only makes up, at the very most, 20 to 25% of a bird's actual diet.
That is very, very
interesting. They're not like us. They haven't picked up on the drive-through mentality of America. They don't need supplements and vitamins and things like that.
Well, and it may help when they're nesting and when they have a relationship with a forest or a field, they would naturally be looking for food in the places that they usually find it.
Definitely.
As well as other places.
And I truly feel that one person feeding birds in their backyard can positively affect biodiversity. I really do. I have that strong feeling that, and if you're feeding them with native resources or if you're feeding them with a bird feeder, I think it is a good thing. It helps. It definitely helps.
Christy and I could go on talking for a week and a half, but we have only got just so much time. And I wanted to remind listeners that there are some very good sources of excellent information about birds. Not just the random internet thing, but reliable information where some of the studies that you have looked at are being done, right?
Yes. Cornell Lab of Ornithology is an amazing resource. Audubon is an amazing resource. Those are who I look to find out any kind of information on our bird populations. What to do, how to do it, where they are, what they're doing. These are the experts in the field, and they have trusted and tested information on their websites.
What's terrific to know. If you want to learn something about a bird, I love the Cornell Labs for Ornithology because they are fascinating and accurate. And those two things are really, birds are fascinating, and we'd like to be accurate.
Definitely.
So, Christy, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Mary.
We always run out of time, sadly.
We'll have to just continue it on another
Well,
one.
I think we will. Okay, so this gets us to our mystery sound. And I thought what I would do is read what it is, and then you may have something you want to add about it after I read this little bit that I'm reading, okay? The mystery sound is a western towhee. These are also called spotted towhees, and they stay year-round in western Washington, but they generally leave eastern Washington in the winter. The male spotted towhee has a solid black head and red eyes that is so striking. White spots appear on the wing edges when folded. Female towhees have dark brown feathers, and they are in the sparrow family. They have dozens of relatives, many of them LBJs, which some of you will not know, means little brown jobs. And as Christy mentioned, when they're hunting food, they kick at the ground in a hopping motion, and they send bits of leaf litter out onto paths and trails. It's as if they dig without shovels. They are nearly omnivorous, and one source I read said they eat snails. I cannot imagine.
I just learned that we have a sparrow here as well that's called the Savannah sparrow. We just had one show up at our feeders this year. Never seen one. We've been there for 17 years, and we had a Savannah sparrow show up this week. And we were reading about them, and they are usually down by the salt marshes, and they eat small crustaceans. That's part of their diet.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
You know, and small crustaceans, probably little snails and things like that on the reeds.
I believe
that the towhees could be right in there as well.
So the order for the day is keep your eyes open. Okay, I'm going to share a couple of events, and I'm very grateful that we've had Christy Lassen here today. There is a bird walk every Wednesday morning at the Dungeness River Audubon Center from 8:30 to 10:30. They know what they're doing, and it's a very interesting way to learn. On May 28th, there is a work party for the Jefferson Land Trust at the Snow Creek Uncas Preserve, and you can check www.saveland.org for more information on this. And a talk I can't wait to hear, Carnivores in Our Midst, on May 29th, at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Port Townsend from 7 to 9. The speakers are Lorna and Daryl Smith, who have spent their lives studying carnivores, especially those in the Pacific Northwest. It's open to all, and it's free. And that's it for today. We hope you have enjoyed our authentic, eclectic, and innovative look at the natural world around us in Western Washington. Nature Now airs Wednesday at noon, Thursday at 5 p.m., and Saturday at 12:30. Thank you.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.